You're listening to Energy Insiders, a weekly update on clean energy and climate policy with Renew Economies editor Giles Parkinson and leading energy analyst David Leach. Energy Insiders is brought to you by Evergen, providing cutting-edge energy management software for battery optimization, virtual power plants and distributed energy resources. And Pylon, helping solar installers and retailers design high-resolution solar proposals in minutes.
Hello and welcome to this latest episode of the Energy Insiders podcast. My name is Giles Parkinson. I'm the editor of Renew Economy, along with its sister sites One Step Off the Grid and the EV Focus The Driven. And joining me as usual is ITK analyst David Leach. David, I trust you are well and recovering from your tennis exertions.
Well, they were a long time ago, early this morning, Giles, and considering the result, I have forgotten them already. I trust you're also well and our listeners, and we're off to Europe this week to talk transport with a great guest.
Yes, we are, and we'll come back after that to sort of discuss the federal budget and some big news coming out of Western Australia too about the acceleration of their renewable energy strategy, which is actually quite fascinating. But look, let's start with the interview, this week's interview. It's with William Todds. He's from Transport and Environment, a European-based think tank focusing on transport emissions. And you talked to him just recently. Let's have a listen.
Welcome to William Todds, Executive Director of Transport and Environment. William, thanks very much for joining the Energy Insiders podcast.
Yeah, thanks. It's good to be here.
Perhaps you could start by telling our listeners here in Australia and internationally a little bit about transport and environment. How many people does it employ? What are its aims?
So Transport and Environment is Europe's leading transport think tank and campaign group. We've been around since 1990. We have our headquarters in Brussels, but we have offices in a few of the big European countries like the UK, Spain, France, Germany. We employ around 100 people and we work on all things that are related to transport, environment and energy. So cars, trucks, planes, ships, hydrogen, LNG, biofuels, you name it. We do work on bikes and buses as well. So all of that.
Pretty globally, or at least in the United States and in Europe, transport generally is around a quarter of carbon emissions. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. In developed economies, it's usually around that number. If you include international aviation and shipping, you get a bit higher. So you would be above 30% in Europe.
Yes, and it's a little less here in Australia, mainly because we're a very heavy energy-intensive economy, but never mind about that. And within the transport sector, I guess it's light passenger vehicles that are the biggest share typically.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. So it's still cars that are the biggest, and then it's trucks, so cars and, let's say, light delivery vehicles, car together, so light duty, then heavy duty, and then aviation and shipping. And so combined, that, you know, that accounts for, two-thirds of oil demand globally.
Yes, that's right. And I can well recall having the head of BP's research department come out here to Australia and tell me that even if cars went all electric, oil demand would stay constant. It used to make me smile because my background is as a financial analyst, and I know that once one scale falls, the others tend to fall as well. I guess with cars is the easiest start, and I think it's the easiest path. But tell me a little bit more, just going back into the history. A few years ago, it would have been difficult to imagine electric vehicles as having progressed as far as they have, or decarbonisation of cars has been, I can't say easy, but that the journey has been as rapid as it has. And I guess a lot has to be due to Tesla, which made the electric vehicle so popular in a way, so it made us see how it could be achieved. But tell us how Transport Environment has been able to achieve its mission, you know, and how you measure your success and how you've been able to grow the organisation, because it seems to me 100 people is quite a lot and a budget of 12 or 13 million euros. What makes an NGO like yours successful?
So our theory of change is that if you want to move big industry, because in a way, a lot of what we do and a lot of the change that needs to happen in our economy is about making big industries change the technology or the fuel they use to produce and to move stuff around. And if you want to do that, there's not many ways you can make Volkswagen or GM move. One way is competition. So you mentioned Tesla. So if you got a competitor that is eating their lunch, they are likely to move. But how do you create that competition? And that's where regulation comes in. We think that one of the best ways to make big industries that are all competing with each other, that never want to move first, and incumbents, if you want to get them to move, you'll probably have to require them to move. And that has been our theory of change since the early 1990s. We were set up to work on clean vehicles and on pricing. We also believe that oil and gas should be more expensive. And so we've been working on fuel economy standards, emission standards since then. And so, you know, a measure for success is, can you get a law adopted that is actually going to drive meaningful change in, you know, one of the big industries that we work on? So that's, for me, that is a good KPI.
And yes, and I guess to do that, I suppose, firstly, you have to make the facts the case. And secondly, you have to get the ear of the policymakers. And I must say, the EU always amazes me as to what a complex instrument or thing it is. It's one of the world's greatest successes since World War II, I think, the EU. But how do you go about becoming a significant voice in the policy debate?
Well, I think it's, in essence, it's about it's about evidence, but it's also about showing that what we are proposing will create a win-win, because the environment movement, we have a voice, we have, you know, there are green parties in many Western European Western countries, but we don't represent 50% of the population. We don't have lots of money. We don't employ millions of people. So actually, our power is relatively limited. So the way we can have influence is by striking alliances with parts of the industries that want to move forward with the labor unions, with consumers. And I think that's what's really interesting about electric vehicles or generally fuel economy, is that there is such a clear win-win for big parts of society and the economy, which is why we've been able to make progress on it. If nobody stands to benefit from something, except the environment, it is generally very hard to make progress. And then you need, usually you need like a big scandal, a big public health scandal for things to actually start moving forward.
Yes, it's not the environment doesn't vote. We've got an environmental defenders office here, but it's kind of we have to interpret what the environment actually wants.
I was reading about the Australian government wanting to do a fuel economy standard yesterday, and the way your government communicates about that, you know, giving people access to affordable electric vehicles. This is, I think, a good example of trying to make the case that EVs are not just going to be good for the climate, they're going to be good for your pocket as well. They're going to be good for your energy dependence. And in the case of Australia, they're going to be good for your economy as well, because you've got plenty of the resources that we need to power the new economy.
I'll come back to Australia, but I wanted to, the approach you've outlined is through regulation is what I might call the stick approach.
Yeah.
But the other way is the carrot, which is the way the United States is going with the Inflation Reduction Act, you know, where there are just these tremendous incentives for everyone to get on board. It's true they were also introducing a stick in the form of emission standards that are going to be a lot tougher than they are at the moment. But in the first place, it was the carrot. Have you had done much thinking about, you know, the appropriate balance or how important carrots are as opposed to the manufacturer, I mean, not just to the consumer?
Yeah. So I think generally our thinking is that the polluter should pay and that we shouldn't be paying the polluter, which is in a way what you're doing through the IRA. And the IRA is is a very impressive piece of legislation, but it's a bit crazy too. If you look at what they're actually doing in terms of subsidies to battery electric vehicles, it's extremely generous. It's probably much more generous than it should be. And I guess that is, you know, how much stick you apply and how much incentive you apply is a matter of perhaps ideology, but also of political reality. And I guess the way Biden has gone about it is to put huge carrots in place, and now little by little he's going to put sticks in place. The way Europe has gone about it is the other way. And I think you refer to the complexity of the European Union. One of the problems with the EU is that it doesn't have money, which is why it is it's primarily a regulator rather than a money distributor. But fundamentally, I do think that if we want a transition that is fair and fast, it should be driven and led by big corporations who have the ability and the resources to make the transition. They do actually have a lot of money, and they are responsible for a lot of pollution.
There's no question about that, but it is interesting the point you make that in Europe, at the EEC level, it pretty much has to be, it does it through regulation, but don't they have their own budget? But they don't have any ability to, they get levies, but they can't kind of give out tax grants in the way that a normal country like England or France or Spain.
That's right. Yeah, that's right. And the money they have is tiny. Now, what they have done as part of their response to the COVID crisis was that this was really unprecedented. They borrowed lots of money. They injected around 750 billion euros into the EU economy. So there is a an emerging fiscal power at EU level, but every time you want to go and borrow money or you want to raise taxes, you need to get the approval of all the EU states, and so that makes it complex. It's not like a country.
No, it is. So it's harder to. So this is the solution depends on the context as usual, and in Europe, the way forward is through regulation, because that's the policy device that is available and can be made to work. And I mean, we can argue about whether it's fair, and that is, of course, always important. But the outcome is ultimately the most important thing, that the job gets done, however it gets done. Do you think? Maybe not.
Yeah, I mean that is it's kind of true, but we also need to consider what is going to work at scale, because like how many industries and how many people can you subsidize to carbon neutrality at the same time? We've been in Europe, we've been paying coal mines to close. Now there's lots of demands from other industries to do the same thing as the IRA. Like our resources, public resources are not unlimited, and there are other needs and other requirements in society. So I think the IRA is in a way it's inspiring, because it is creating a dynamism that is unprecedented in the West, at least. But I think there's limits to how much subsidies you can give. Like if you think about the battery subsidies they're giving, like the $30, $35 to $45 per kilowatt hour, if the EV market in the US really takes off very, very fast, this becomes a hugely expensive policy. And then the question is, why are you actually doing this? Because these vehicles and the battery costs have come down spectacularly, and actually both car makers and consumers would be able to afford this. So how long do you continue this? And I think, once that starts to happen, there's going to be people in the country that say, well, you're actually wasting a lot of taxpayer money on something that is already very cheap, and you're putting taxpayer dollars into corporate pockets.
I agree, William, but I suspect whatever policy you adopt, there'll always be some people who say you're wasting a lot of money.
That's true.
It's just a question of how many of them there are.
Yeah.
And in any case, I think that the practical and I might say, although we're talking about transport today, I was very struck myself as someone that focuses a lot on wind and solar and generation, stationary electricity, that electricity, wind and solar prices in the United States with the tax subsidies can be US 10 to US $20 a megawatt hour, which is incredibly cheap by global standards. And so it's something that everyone, it will attract a lot of investment. And Without getting too far down this track, what are you hearing about how the EC is going to cope with this?
Well, it has led to a bit of a panic at some point, because you know we had this wonderful plan which was based entirely on regulations, and on the basis of those regulations, so we had the 100% zero emission vehicle sales target by 2035, and on the basis of that, battery makers and car makers were planning investments in Europe, you know, be it gigafactories or refining facilities. And then the IRA came, and then a lot of those companies said, well, actually, the US is a much more attractive place to invest now. So we're actually going to go to the United States first, and then we'll see. So that led to a panic. And the EU has responded, and they've done three things. One, they said that the rules for giving subsidies to companies, which in Europe are very strict, because I don't know how much you want to know about this, but historically, the EU is, you know, it's a bunch of countries coming together, and you want to avoid that the richest countries, such as Germany, subsidize their industry and then outcompete all the rest. So you can't give excessive subsidies in Europe normally. So that is changing. You can actually give a lot of subsidies now. So if, let's say, a battery company is going to get 2 billion or 5 billion in the US, Germany can give them 2 or 5 billion as well. That's a huge change. I mean, that's really a revolution in the way we think about subsidies. The other thing we've done is made big changes to permitting rules, or are proposing big changes to that, because it's hard to get projects off the ground in Europe. It's heavily populated. There's lots of environmental and other rules that make it, you know, difficult to get stuff built fast. That's a challenge in the green transition. And the final point is around critical minerals, where there's now going to be a big effort to get mining, refining in and outside Europe off the ground to the benefit of the European economy. So there's been a very serious response, but it is not matching the IRA, because we don't have the fiscal firepower the US has.
No, I don't think you know, very few countries actually can match what the USA is doing, and I'm sure it's going to be effective in the short term. And I guess, you know, as much as it's going to harm everyone else, it's still going to be good for the globe, decarbonisation. And so
anyway, I agree.
Now tell me, just coming back to the, you know, the light car thing. There was a lot of talk about these e-fuels, and I must say I still don't fully understand, and I don't ever hope I never have to understand e-fuels, but to what extent are we going to be all electric or electric and hydrogen, ICE cars by 2035 in Europe? Is that a done deal now?
The law has been adopted, and the law says that in 2035, 100% of vehicles sold need to be emissions free. That is one thing. Now, I think the whole e-fuels debate, it's actually a proxy war, because e-fuels are not really a thing. E-fuels are fantasy fuels. Yeah, you need lots of renewable electricity, turn it into hydrogen, then synthesize it with a source of carbon, which actually you need to take directly from the air. So you need DAC, and then you're going to burn that in a 20-30% efficient engine. It's absolutely insane. So we're not going to do that at scale. But e-fuels are not a serious proposition. They are a story that the opponents of electrification are telling. And whether it's true or not doesn't matter that much. So this is what the opposition has rallied around. And the thing about EU regulations is that they do get reviewed. And before 2035, lawmakers will again have to confirm that, yes, we're definitely going to do that. And that's going to happen in 2026, 2027. So there will be another fight about this. But I think that the direction of travel is now so clear that it will be very hard to fundamentally shift this target.
Right. And then also where cars go, I personally think a lot of the heavier road transport will also go, certainly for truckloads within cities, intra-city sort of trucks will have even more advantages than cars in a lot of cases, won't they?
Yeah, And I'm glad you say that, because there's a lot of people that that say, "Oh, but trucks are so different." But actually, you know, the automotive system is one system. There, you know, they have many of the same supply chains. It goes for the combustion engine system today, and it will be the same thing for the electric system in the future. And the heavy duty side of the auto industry is very small. So indeed, they will follow what happens in the auto industry. And if we have a massive scaling up of gigafactories and battery costs go down and batteries get better and better, yeah, the future for trucks, and not just urban or suburban or regional, I think all of it is going to be electric. I think it's hard to imagine how, say, fuel cell trucks are gonna be very big if, you know, if 90% of the auto system goes battery electric. How do you scale up industrially a fuel cell heavy duty system? That's a question I have.
I completely agree with that. At the same time, of course, we've got a temporarily, I don't think the cost of EVs has shifted very much, you know, and there is always this sort of race with charging infrastructure. And I suppose that's another area where, is it national country policy or EEC-wide policy about charging infrastructure that actually matters?
Look, we're doing, I think you need, if you want to shift as fast as we want to shift, in the next 10 years, basically, we want to go all electric for new vehicle sales, then you need to move at all levels at the same time. What the EU has done is they have said, they've created a law that says that all countries need to put in place fast charging infrastructure along their highways, so that, you know, whether you're going to Poland or Romania or Italy or Norway, you're going to be able to charge. So that's important. And they are doing that both for cars and for trucks. So for trucks, every, I think, 60 kilometer, there needs to be a mega charger installed by 26 or 27. So that's a huge deal, especially the trucks piece. Is like, yeah, if I would have said 5 years ago to people that we were going to have a law that required mega chargers for trucks, I don't think anyone would have believed that. But the reality is that most of the charging, both for passenger cars and for heavy vehicles, is going to be private, either at home or for the trucks at the depot or at the logistics center. And so it's, you know, a lot of that work is going to be around getting grid connections for the heavy vehicles. And just, you know, installing small chargers for at homes, but that's very easy. And then, you know, you've got the shared buildings, the cities, that's a bit more challenging.
Yeah, okay, let's just talk about that for 1 second. You know, in Australia, just to digress, we have two problems. One, in our rural network, it's just a lot of roads with a lot of distances. And so it's hard to get superchargers that are not going to get high capacity utilization for some time. Plus, you also have to have the actual reliable transmission infrastructure there to provide the power that's needed, the 200 kilowatts. But leaving that entirely to one side, how do you deal with cities and, you know, apartment? That's an issue that that I'm interested in.
So I think this is mostly, if, let's say, apartment buildings. Usually in Europe, apartment buildings will have a parking lot. And so there the challenge is an organizational challenge. How do you put in place the cabling and the chargers so that, you know, that everybody can charge? And you know, that is an expense. And so you have to convince everybody that lives in the building to make the investment, which currently is hard. So you got to find a way, either a business model or a legal way to make that much easier. And I think there's a couple of examples of countries doing that, where essentially if you have the right to plug, where I lived in Brussels, I had the right to plug, so I can just tell my landlord and everybody lived in the building, I'm going to install charging. So that's, you know, that's one way. For those people that don't have access to on-site parking, I do not know exactly what the model is going to be. There are two schools of thinking. One says that we're going to put lots and lots of slow chargers in cities, be it at shops or on street. But there's also people that say that it could be very similar to to refueling your petrol car. So we have these fast charging stations in and around cities. And if you live in a city, you don't drive, you know, thousands of kilometers per week. You usually drive very little. So you go charge every 1 or 2 weeks at a fast charging station, and that's it.
Yep. Sounds good to me. And one other point before we move off cars is that I think one of the things transport and environment has points have been making is that plug-in cars really aren't the answer that a lot of hybrids, if I can put it that way, aren't the answer that that they're sometimes made out to be, that you know, you really want to go fully electric if you going to do the emissions reduction.
Yeah, that is true. Just to share a perspective on this, one of the things the auto industry does is it shoots itself in the foot. So I remember I've been with TNE for 13 years now. So I remember telling the auto industry together with colleagues, guys, your diesel engines, you got a problem there. You need to clean up your diesel engines, or people are going to lose trust in your diesel engines. That was before Dieselgate. And they said, oh, no. And then at some point we said to the auto industry, your plug-in hybrid cars, this is not very serious. You've got a massive SUV and it can drive 20 kilometers electric. That is not a serious zero emission proposition. You need to do much better than that. And then they resisted that. And then actually, you know, the public lost faith in that in a technology that, you know, that in the last years or in the next few years could have, you know, made a small contribution. But fundamentally, of course, yeah, if you want to go zero emission, hybrid cars are not a very good idea, because they're not the best of both worlds. They're the worst of both worlds. You've got a suboptimal vehicle carrying around a lot of additional weight that it doesn't need.
Yep, I agree with that very much. More or less like a committee, aren't they, really? I mean, that's a bad joke.
Yeah.
I'd like to talk a little bit about shipping for the next. I don't know quite what the question, but I suppose one of the most important or interesting global statistics I've read in the last couple of years, and there's certainly been lots of them, and perhaps the most interesting statistic ever to come out of the United Nations, was that about 40% of shipping is actually the shipping of fossil fuels. So I guess to an extent, the shipping industry will get fixed one way or another, but at the same time, it's an industry that's going to resist change because it's got a lot to lose from it.
Yeah, that is a very interesting statistic, which, by the way, applies to rail freight to some extent as well. They also carry a lot of fossil fuels. Even if some part of the shipping industry is no longer carrying around oil and gas and coal, there's still going to be a lot of, you know, container ships moving around the globe. So it's a sector that does pollute. I think fundamentally the challenge that we have with shipping is twofold. One, it's the energy side, and two, it's the fact that we're dealing with a genuinely international sector. Now, for a very long time in Europe, we said it is international, so we don't deal with it. We asked the International Maritime Organization in London to solve this problem for us. And that usually when you ask the UN to solve a problem for you, that doesn't work very well. So in 2019, the Commission said, we're going to bring shipping into the EU climate sphere. We're going to put a carbon price on ships, and we're going to put a mandate on ship owners, ship operators, to start using different type of fuels. And they just made a deal on that. And the agreement is that by 2030, 1% of the fuels that ships run on should be what we call RFNBO fuels, which is basically hydrogen-based fuels. And that, you know, and then I'll shut up, but the long-term challenge for both aviation and shipping and for all these sectors where direct electrification isn't possible is to, yeah, is basically a hydrogen-based solution, because biofuels cannot be scaled sustainably.
Yeah, and I think that's, so you really aviation and shipping are still on the very hard list,
yeah.
If we're honest about it, aren't they? I mean, it's great to have a policy, but it's one where you need incentives as much as penalties, don't you, to encourage some failed experiments as well as successful ones, hopefully.
Yeah, although, I mean, the way I'm looking at that is the aviation, the shipping industry are two sectors that are not paying taxes. The aviation industry is not paying taxes on its fuel in Europe, on its on its tickets in many cases. The shipping industry is basically not paying any taxes because they're all based in tax havens. So these guys have some ability to pay.
I suppose they do, but at the same time, if they do pay, those costs, speaking as an economist, those costs will surely get passed on to consumers one way or another.
Indeed, indeed. And I think the consumers of aviation services, you know, generally people that fly are not the poorest in society. Generally, the people that fly a lot are the richest in society, here again, you can compare the US and the EU. What we've done in Europe is we have created a mandate. So 5% of aviation fuel in 2030 needs to be either biofuels or e-kerosene. So that's an e-fuel. And in the US, they're giving very big tax incentives. So that's a different approach.
Yes. Just remind me very quickly what is e-kerosene?
Well, e-kerosene is like e-fuels, but then for planes. So it's entirely the same process. You take hydrogen, you combine it with carbon, you turn it into a synthetic fuel, which you then burn into a plane. It is, you know, it's similarly challenging. The only difference is that for aviation, you really don't have any alternatives right now.
Okay, and so my next question, just moving back to the broader topics, William, as we come towards the end of this very interesting discussion. Firstly, I guess, how set do you think, firstly, the EEC is, and secondly, the members of the EEC are on decarbonisation of transport and decarbonisation generally? You know, has last year's or the current war, rather, with Ukraine and the high prices of gas last year, and have that, what's that actually done to policy and the will of the people, in your opinion?
I think what's been remarkable to see is that, so the European Green Deal was announced in 2019, and it was the result of elections where lots of people voted for green or greenish parties. And then, you know, they came up with this very ambitious policy agenda, and then there was COVID, and you would have expected them to scale it down a little bit, but they didn't. And actually, public support remained high. And then there was the war, which a lot of people also thought was going to be bad for the energy transition. But it actually turns out that it is accelerating the energy transition in Europe. So I think there is still a lot of support for the energy transition in Europe and for decarbonization. But it is also true that what we have agreed in Europe on, in terms of cars, but also the power sector, the decarbonization of buildings, the creation of new sticks also on people, because there's a carbon tax that is going to be applied to heating fuel, to transport fuel. All of this combined is extremely ambitious, and it now needs to be implemented in the next couple of years. We got a target of minus 55% carbon emissions by 2030. That's in 6-7 years. Most countries are not on track. It's going to be a hell of a challenge to deliver that target. And I think that's where it doesn't worry me. This is what we need to do, but that's going to be the challenge, and to move very fast and in a quite radical manner, and to still keep everybody on side, that's going to be difficult. And that's the challenge that every nation is going to have to go through.
And just remind me again, because what happens if a country doesn't actually meet a mandate that the EEC law requires?
Well, if a company doesn't meet the target, it gets fined, and it's automatic. If a country doesn't meet the target, ultimately it will also get fined, but it is a more political process, because the Commission is not purely independent. The boss of the Commission is the countries. So before it can find the countries, it usually takes a little while, and the country needs to be very, very bad behaving to actually get a fine. But ultimately, that's what happens.
So ultimately, it's not that different to... ultimately, it's only really going to be if all the countries decide to backslide, there's not a heck of a lot that can actually be done very easily. But then why make the decision in the first place?
Well, it's the same in the US. You've got elections. It's the same in Australia. Like this is going to be a continuous challenge for the next decades. Like every election, we will have to get this confirmed. And, you know, sometimes we will, things will go slower. There will be a bit of backsliding, but fundamentally, climate change is real. And we are now in a situation where in Europe, there hasn't been a lot of rain and snow in winter. People were complaining they couldn't go skiing, but now there's actually not a lot of water in the south, and it's only April.
That was my daughter. She went all the way from Australia to France to go skiing, and there wasn't any snow.
Yeah, that was very disappointing. Yeah, but now there's no water.
Now, I also wanted to, what would your priorities be? That is transport and environment's priorities over the next 12 or 18 months?
Over the next 12 to 18 months. I mean, the big priority right now is to get a similar rule to the one that we have for cars adopted for trucks. So that is being discussed right now, a minus 90% target for heavy duty vehicles. That's going to be a huge deal if we get that through. And then in 12 months time, we have the EU election. So I think our priority is to get the next EU Commission and the next EU Parliament to continue on the same track. And I think we need to spend more efforts on aviation and shipping in particular. And then I think the other big challenge is to integrate the transport and the energy sector, because, you know, for people talk about the energy sector as if it includes oil and transport, but actually in reality it hasn't for a very long time. But that is changing, as you refer to that. I think that's going to be a big challenge.
No, it is all a whole series of ongoing challenges, I guess. And you know, in Australia, where I suppose we start from the electrify the electricity system, production system, green that up, and then move outwards from there. But we will have to see how it goes. William, have you? I wish you all the success in your mission and transport and environment's mission. Have you got any sort of thoughts that you should leave Australian NGOs with about how to make it happen, how to succeed at the goal?
God, that's a hard question because I don't know the Australian context that well. I think the one thing that I've been amazed at, and that is really playing to our advantage, is that there's so much technological progress. So much is possible. When I started, the best car in the world was a Toyota Prius, at least from an environmental perspective. Right now, we can go all electric. When I started, aviation was, we were never going to be able to solve aviation. Now, at least we have some idea how to do it. I think we can be, we talk a lot about the challenges, but I think we need to be optimistic, and then we need to work together with those parts of society and industry and business that stand to gain from a transition. That is, that's how I think about this, working together, because in a democracy, that ultimately that's how it works, right? That's how change happens.
Yes, hopefully. I'm a wonderful fan of democracy, although occasionally it makes me nervous.
the advantage is that even if you're nervous or upset, you can always go to the vote and kick them out, which is a bit more difficult in other systems.
And vice versa.
Yeah. That's right, yeah.
And that's the part that makes me nervous. William Todd, thank you very much for joining the Energy Insiders podcast. It's been a pleasure, and I hope we can do it again in another time.
Fantastic. Thanks so much.
Powered by All Energy Australia, the New South Wales Clean Energy event, Energy Next, returns to the International Convention Centre in Darling Harbour on July 18 and 19. This free-to-attend exhibition and conference is a must for industry suppliers and experts and those involved in the renewable energy and energy storage sectors. featuring leading international and national brands such as Schneider Electric, Investment New South Wales, 5B and more, you can't afford to miss this free event. Register now for Energy Next 2023, July 18 and 19 at the International Convention Centre, Darling Harbour, Sydney.
And that was William Todds from Transport and Environment. David, fascinating interview as usual. Food for thought for Australia, particularly as we are finally embarking on our electric vehicle transition. We're up to 8% of total sales are now electric, which is not bad considering it's almost impossible to actually get an electric car in Australia. You have to be pretty determined to get one. And we're also in the midst of considering how strong and how soon our vehicle emission standards, and that's the thing that's really been dragging back the whole EV transition in Australia.
Indeed. And of course, in Australia, we have particular issues around the charging network, I think, especially for those of us that are not in cities. Where, you know, my experience is that without the NRMA, a lot of us would be stuck, but the NRMA is so far focused on, so for instance, 50 kilowatt chargers, and you know, you can basically recharge eight cars a day in 8 hours on 50 kilowatts, and we need to do a lot better than that.
Yeah, well, look, the good news is that they've recently announced an agreement with the federal government. I think it's a lot of co-funding, 117 new fast charging stations around Australia. And I think those are going to be up to 400 kilowatt hours. So obviously bringing in new equipment and a range of different providers, Kempower and Tritium and what have you. Moving back to Australia's broader emissions profile, the federal budget came down this week. A few little goodies for the clean energy industry, $2 billion for a hydrogen fund. $1 billion for home energy efficiency to be sort of passed through the Clean Energy Finance Corporation, some extra money for low-income housing, social housing, which is good. I think the general gist of the reaction was fantastic, but can we do a little bit more, like a lot more?
I don't think it was that fantastic, to be honest, Giles. Really, I was a bit disappointed in some ways, and I also not completely sure that, for instance, having the Clean Energy Finance Corporation work out whether your double glazing's going to work or not seems a very bureaucratic approach to it to me, in terms of energy efficiency for housing. But I think the thing that most struck me about it was the complete opacity of the lost the words for a second. And if you read the budget words on that, they're not disclosing how much it's going to cost. They're not disclosing how the mechanism's going to be done. It's not clear whether anyone in the private sector will be able to even apply for any capacity infrastructure subsidies or whatever they are. And in general, the whole thing didn't really, I don't think, hasn't. Normally, Chris Barnes has been fantastic with how he's been able to disclose the detail in schemes and everything, but the capacity infrastructure scheme certainly doesn't meet the standard that I think it should have.
Well, certainly not yet. Mind you, I guess we've hardly seen any results of any sort of state-based auctions and tenders and the pricing of it. Although I suppose we did see it in New South Wales just recently with the LTESs, and previously we've seen it with the ACT government in their PPAs. What is interesting, though, is that it sounds like the auctions are going to get underway at the end of the year, although the budget papers seem to suggest that they haven't actually designed the damn things or finished the design of it. And there's been a few million dollars awarded to the Department of Climate Change, presumably to bring in consultants to advise on how that should be done. There is an indication that South Australia and Victoria will be the first off, which kind of makes sense, I guess. New South Wales is already well on its path, and Queensland sort of already committed to hydro. And I don't know, David, whether you really expect the budget to be revealed for the capacity. I mean, because people can work backwards and work out what to bid, couldn't they?
Well, but I mean, let's say you're a big, you're thinking about putting in a big battery, like, for instance, you're a private sector guy that wants to put in one of these West Australian 500 megawatt 4-hour batteries, and you want to know whether you can, the capacity investment scheme is any use to you You're not a state government. You can't just work it out at COAG. I mean, there should be a formal scheme with formal rules for who can qualify and how. And if there's lots of people that want to get stuff, then they should all be able to apply and have it judged on their merits, surely. Isn't that the way it's done? You can't just have money for mates because your mates happen to be in a Labor government in the state. I'm stating it at its worst, but, you know, really, it's schemes should be open fairly widely, in my opinion, or else they should be described as, you know, federal-state funding arrangements, if that's what, in fact, they are.
Well, we may find out later on this year when we see the final design of the schemes and they actually sort of settle on how much capacity they want to order. Then we might actually get to those are sort of the key components. I mean, how much are they going to be offering in each of the auctions and when? So, look, you mentioned Western Australia and the 500 megawatt battery, 500 megawatt four-hour battery. We thought initially that must be Neoen's battery in Collie, the coal town there, because they've proposed a 1 gigawatt battery there, as we revealed or we discussed in the recent interview with Louis de Sombussy, the head of Neoen Australia, on this very podcast a few weeks ago. But it turns out we were wrong, and it's actually the Synergy, the state-owned utility, that's going to be building that big battery. So 500 megawatts, 1,000 megawatt hours. They're going to be... 2,000 megawatt hours. So that's the biggest battery in Australia so far. So that's pretty exciting. And it came a day after the WA government released this plan to build about 51 gigawatts of wind, solar and storage over the next 20 years. And a lot of it sort of fast-tracked, front-ended, actually, which was really interesting. And they're really looking at the sort of the clean industry, the critical minerals, the electrification of industries in Western Australia. So that's actually, that's pretty interesting, because when you think about the AEMO sponsored or the whole of, well, actually, maybe that's unfair, that the market report that was released a couple of years ago, it barely touched on the expansion of renewables in that state. And all of a sudden here, they've come up with this new plan saying, okay, we've got to build 50 gigawatts of this stuff in about 20 years. And I fancy that a lot of that has to do with people who want to create industries in Western Australia and say, look, it can't come from a heavily polluting grid. It's got to come from a clean grid. And if that's the case, that's really interesting, because that's basically industry telling the government, we've got to have a clean grid, it's got to be renewables, we can do so much here. And that is just this massive counterpoint to the fossil fuel industry and the mining industry, which has just basically had its hands all over that government for the last few decades.
Well, the first thing they'll have to do is build a whole lot of new transmission, just like everyone in the east has to do, and let's see how that goes. You know, I've almost got to the point where grand announcements are cheap. I'm more interested in what you can actually deliver this year. And if we turn from West Australia, where the announcement's just been made this week, to New South Wales, which made its announcement back in 2020, and we now find that the first bit of transmission infrastructure for that delivered under that particular program, the Orana connection, won't be in operation before 2027. You know, it just shows you how long many podcasts we'll be having, Giles, before we'll be talking about much actual delivery in West Australia.
Another 165 by my calculations.
I want to go on from that and say that I just, you know, I continue to be disturbed by what I see as the wrong message that the new Labor Minister, Penny Sharp, is sending out, which is about we've got to keep the lights on, and this probably means keeping Eraring going and we might have to buy it back. You know, the message needs to be, why aren't we, what can we do to speed up the renewable delivery a bit faster and get over this very slow rollout that's coming through? Now, we're now into the phase of announcing a gigawatt of LTESAs every 6 months in New South Wales. But, you know, the interstate transmission links from Queensland and Victoria, progress there is incredibly slow. And the intrastate links are very slow, but we've said a lot about transmission. The thing that increasingly disturbs me is how long it takes the obstacles still in front of getting wind farms developed and even solar farms, and the fact that we're not really doing much with the renewable energy zones in terms of being able to have like a renewable energy zone planning purpose, so that, you know, you only need to do 1 year of, say, bird studies for the whole of the renewable energy zone, and you can get the community and social approval, the social license for one way or another for the zone, and then get on and actually take some of the obstacles away from actually developing things. Like, for instance, Tilt, just to mention one, it's publicly available, has a 1 gigawatt Liverpool Ranges wind farm. There's the Ungular wind farm. There's this thing around Walker that's run into Barnaby Joyce Flack. There's a ton of stuff that's ready that could go where, in my opinion, the state government could do a lot more to progress things. I mean, the planning laws around wind were held back originally by the Liberals, Anthony Roberts, who you know, years and years ago, made it difficult before, and it seems to me things still haven't improved very much.
Well, let's hope they do. We did actually sort of manage to ask a few questions of Penny Sharp after her appearance at the Smart Energy Council last week, and she did sort of say, well, we're looking to accelerate and we'll try and find to accelerate. So that was good, and let's hope that she does, as you say, focus on the acceleration part of it, of acceleration of renewables, rather than the delaying of coal closures, because that would just be catastrophic for so many different reasons. David, I'm not...
Charles, I think we should give a big shout out to the Smart Energy Conference, because I don't know what you thought, but I thought they did a fantastic job with the number of presentations there.
Oh, no, absolutely. No, they continue to be an excellent conference, and got some very good people. The relevant energy ministers, including the Federal Energy Minister, Chris Bowen, and of course, many of the... of the leading analysts and people actually sort of doing stuff. So so congratulations to them. David, I think that might be a bit of a wrap for this week. What do you reckon?
Yes, I think that pretty well covers it, Giles. I think it does.
It does indeed. And look, I'd just like to point out too that after a sabbatical, we have reproduced our first episode of the Solar Insiders podcast for a few months. So that's available also on Renew Economy. And we've also got another episode of the Driven podcast, including a very interesting interview with Stanford University's Tony Sieber, a futurist and someone who's predicted some sort of very rapid transitions in various industries, and I think that's well worth a listen. Thanks to William Todds for joining us from Transport and Environment over in Europe. Thanks, of course, to our sponsors Evergen and Pylon. Thanks to you, David. Thanks to everyone out there, and we'll be back next week with another episode of the Energy Insiders podcast, and bye for now.
Energy Insiders was brought to you by Evergen, the market-leading renewable energy software business that optimises residential and commercial solar and battery systems. Evergen enables large numbers of systems to operate as a single fleet, so network operators can use them as a virtual power plant, generating significant value for consumers, network operators, and the energy system as a whole. Evergen software is powering the energy system of the future. Energy Insiders was also brought to you by Pylon. Pylon provides easy-to-use solar design software for installers and retailers with pay-as-you-go pricing, no monthly cost, and no locking contracts. Join Australia's top solar companies who trust Pylon to design high-resolution, CEC-ready solar proposals.